With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us again today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, a pistachio grower is highlighting the importance of pre-plant irrigation for cover crops. But our top story today, Rod Thain has warned that Baltimore Bridge collapse.
The aftermath of the dramatic collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge near Baltimore, Maryland, in the early morning hours of March 24th, from the impact by a disabled cargo ship.
The search and rescue operation is our top priority. Ship traffic in the Port of Baltimore has been suspended until further notice, and we'll need to clear that channel before the ship traffic can resume. The Army Corps of Engineers is on the spot and is going to help lead this effort to clear the channel.
President Joe Biden discussing federal efforts in the briefing hours after the incident. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg later explained to reporters the Port of Baltimore's significance in that.
This is an important port for both imports and exports, and it's America's largest vehicle handling port, which is important not only for car imports and exports, but also for farm equipment.
With the state of Maryland listing over 1.3 million tons of roll-on and roll-out tractors, combines, and hay balers in 2023. In addition, farm and food commodities such as sugar, soybeans, grains, and coffee are imported and exported at the Port of Baltimore. That has led to dialogue over the past week to address potential supply chain disruptions and mitigation strategies. That included a meeting in that time frame of the White House Supply Chain Disruption Task Force and members of the ag sector. One potential strategy in play: diversion of cargo ships to other East Coast ports.
This is not of the proportions of, for example, LA and Long Beach when it comes to container traffic. That's one port complex or two ports that collectively represent 40% of U.S. container traffic. It's nothing like that, but it is an important port and an important system of the East Coast ports. Now, a lot of the goods that come on or off there go as part of runs where ships also visit the ports of New York and New Jersey and Virginia. And so right now, I think there are already diversions taking place to those and other East Coast ports, helping to absorb some of that need.
In addition, the Port of Baltimore is the destination for finishing of some light-duty vehicles. Secretary Buttigieg acknowledged that other East Coast port facilities also have finishing operations on their grounds. Yet he adds, for tractor and other farm equipment needing finishing, that aspect of the supply chain is more complicated. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Corn and soybean prices are supported by information in USDA's Prospective Planting Report. Gary Crawford has more.
Last week's USDA Prospective Plantings report sent a signal to the corn markets, and the markets sent a signal right back again. That report shows that corn growers intend to plant 90 million acres to corn this spring. Now, that would be a cut from last year of about 5%.
Compared to trade expectations, we were about 1.5 million acres lower on corn acres intentions at 90 million acres.
And USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says 90 million corn acres is a lot less than the markets expected.
And the corn stocks came in a little bit on the lighter end of trade expectations as well.
So that, along with the acreage number, sent corn prices up by about 3.5%. Now, in a so-called normal year, whatever that is, when you cut corn planting intentions, you usually get an equivalent increase in soybean acres. But according to what producers told USDA, they intend to cut corn acres by 5%, but only boost soybean acres by 3%, putting in 86.5 million acres of beans. That would be right about what industry analysts had expected. Meanwhile, U.S. wheat acreage looks to be down 4% from last year, cotton up 4%. But remember, farmers were surveyed about their planting plans 2 to 3 weeks ago.
And so there is opportunity for farmers to change their mind.
Lance Honig with USDA's Ag Statistics Service.
There is the possibility that the economic situation could change. There's the possibility that weather may not cooperate with what some of those plans are.
And in some years, actual planted acres end up being significantly different from what farmers said in the planting intentions report.
But for now, this gives us an idea of what farmers are thinking as of the conditions that exist today.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Chuck Zimmerman brings us today's National Spotlight.
At Commodity Classic, I'm visiting with Liz Hunt with Syngenta. And first of all, Liz, tell us what you do.
I head our Sustainable and Responsible Business Team for North America, which is kind of the intersection of corporate responsibility and commercial solutions for sustainability.
Well, tell us a little bit about how Syngenta is helping customers, growers, to use data, for example, to advance their on-farm sustainability and improve their productivity and output.
So the data question is always the biggest challenge for sustainability, but the approach that we have taken with our sustainability team at Syngenta is thinking about sustainability as kind of a giant swimming pool, where you've got the deep end of the swimming pool and you have a shallow end of the swimming pool, and sustainability is anywhere along that whole spectrum. So we want solutions for farmers to meet them wherever they are in that sustainability journey. So we have, you know, shallow end approach for both our CropWise sustainability, which is just a series of yes-no questions that can tell you how are you doing in 30 minutes or so on your sustainability journey, to deeper data analytics at a field level where you can really dig into, you know, some of those field level agronomic questions or understanding the nutrient use efficiency, the yields, the productivity, the profitability at that deep field level end of the spectrum.
Do you think that farmers are more knowledgeable about this and wanting to do more sustainable practices?
So I think farmers are one of the most knowledgeable on sustainable practices on their farms, and they always have been. I think what's bringing more maybe of a spotlight to some of this conservation ag is around some of the investments that are being made with the Climate Smart grants that were announced last year. Different programs, a lot more food companies and such are making more public commitments and are getting more engaged at the farm level. And I think that's driving some of the interest. But I would still go back to farmers know their sustainability story first. And there's just more kind of spotlight with some of these ancillary programs.
What do you think you're going to be talking to these growers coming in here? What would be the questions you expect to have to answer to them?
Well, what is sustainability is the first question that always comes up. And, you know, we can talk about that from a textbook definition of sustainability with grounding yourself in, you know, the environment and the profitability and the social components of it. But I think one of the things that kind of is continuing to reoccur, farmers, again, have a lot of great sustainability stories, but how can they ground that story in something that's credible and something, you know, that kind of gives a bit of a framework to that discussion? And that's what we've really tried to do with our CropWise sustainability app too, and the standard that we wrote within there is to give them that framework so they can talk about crop production, they can talk about soil health, they can talk about, you know, the water impact on their operation, human animal health, biodiversity, community leadership. There's so many different aspects of sustainability, and everybody's doing something, and everybody has an opportunity to do something more, and we just try to frame that up for them.
I guess before closing out here, what would be the main thing that you would want growers to know?
I think everybody has a really great story to tell, so take that opportunity to tell that story every chance you get. People want to hear from farmers. They trust farmers. They love to eat. So anytime they get that opportunity to tell their own story, that's more meaningful than anything either of us could ever tell to consumers.
Well, thank you very much, Liz, for visiting with me here. We're at the 2024 Commodity Classic. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, an important product keeping feed safe faces uncertainty after a new risk assessment. David Geiger has this report.
The Environmental Protection Agency released its draft formaldehyde risk evaluation this month, finding it poses a, quote, unreasonable risk to human health, unquote, claiming effects from sensory irritation to lung damage or even cancer. However, the EPA notes that, quote, these risks may not apply to everyone everywhere and describes some of the sources of uncertainties in EPA's findings, unquote. The American Feed Industry Association is concerned the agency is ignoring 40 years of science and creating unreasonable levels. Gary Huddleston, its director of feed manufacturing and regulatory affairs, says formaldehyde is a vital feed additive.
It's a very effective way to control pathogens in feed, things like salmonella, E. coli, and it prevents those pathogens from getting into the animal and then eventually getting into the human food supply. And so it's just a very effective tool that we've used very, very safely for years and years.
Huddleston says restrictions would be frustrating. In feed mills, formaldehyde already has strict safety standards, controlled with automatic equipment with specialized employees that come out to check and test. The process is a closed system.
It's in a tank, it's metered, it's completely controlled by the computerized batching systems that we utilize in our feed mills today. And so it's no employees ever touch it.
And despite there already being OSHA standards, Huddleston believes the risk assessment out from the EPA will cause changes that would devastate the industry.
The exposure level that EPA is going to try to set is going to be so far below that it's going to be impossible to manufacture any longer.
Huddleston adds the level tossed around by EPA would be over what's naturally produced.
Half of the American population would be illegal with just breathing out because we have, you know, formaldehyde's a naturally occurring thing in our body. So we would just be above EPA standard just from breathing.
And should a ban take place, companies would have to find alternative methods to dealing with salmonella.
And in a lot of production systems, there's no better method than formaldehyde. One of the things that formaldehyde does, it kills the virus, but it also kills the salmonella, but it also keeps it, the feed salmonella free for 21 days. And that's plenty long enough for the feed to get through the animal. And so we don't have any recontamination of salmonella.
New research even shows formaldehyde could be a key part of fighting an outbreak of African swine fever should it reach the U.S. Huddleston says the American Feed Industry Association has formed a coalition against the risk assessment and is looking to fight it. I'm David Geiger reporting.
Join me back tomorrow to hear the latest on USDA disaster relief programs, an important tool in a livestock producer's toolbox, and to hear more on USDA researchers' discussion to change the program. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Pre-plant irrigation can have a significant effect on the success of a cover crop. Vice President of Matoyan Brothers LLC, Richard Matoyan, described the cover crop mix they're using in their pistachio orchards and compared the results of different pre-plant irrigation approaches.
We ended up going with a mix of 45% bell beans, 35% peas, 10% vetch, and 10% barley. We had about five rows in the front of the orchard that didn't have pipeline to do the flood irrigation. So those didn't get pre-irrigation, and there's a marked difference between what was pre-irrigated and planted and what was not pre-irrigated and then planted. The pre-irrigated stuff probably is 2.5 to 3 feet tall. The stuff that was not pre-irrigated is probably standing only less than a foot tall. Big, big difference.
The winners have been announced for the Radical Natural Plant Protection Challenge by UPL. The challenge aimed to recognize startups advancing natural and biological solutions, receiving 237 applications. UPL Corporation and Radical Growth have awarded Celasta Bio with the first place prize of $1 million in investment and $750,000 to Impetus Ag as the runner-up. Celasta Bio was selected for its nature-inspired, selectively targeted, and sustainable peptide insect control products, while Impetus Ag was chosen for its novel proteins that bind naturally occurring toxins to targeted pests. Both companies will receive support and access to networks from UPL Corp and Radical Growth. The winners were announced at a pitch day event on March 18th, and alongside funding, they will benefit from expert guidance to accelerate their growth and development. The Bipartisan Farm Transition Act of 2024 seeks to address the impending transfer of over 370 million acres of farmland over the next 20 years. The act aims to reauthorize the Commission on Farm Transitions, which was initially developed as part of the 2018 Farm Bill. This commission, consisting of 10 members, would study and make recommendations on aspects of transitioning ag operations to the next generation. Key areas of focus include assessing the availability of quality land, infrastructure, and financial resources, as well as evaluating current asset transfer strategies and potential improvements. Additionally, the commission would examine incentives to facilitate transfers and review the effectiveness of existing programs. The Act aims to support aspiring farmers and safeguard farmland for future generations by identifying challenges and proposing solutions through comprehensive research and policy initiatives. The Department of Fish and Wildlife, in collaboration with the California Waterfowl Association, is accepting applications for two nesting bird initiatives, the Delayed Cereal Grain Harvest and Fallow Agriculture programs. The Delayed Grain Harvest program incentivizes farmers to delay grain field harvest until at least July 15th, benefiting ground nesting birds. Farmers receive $50 an acre with potential additional payments for increased monitoring. The Fallow Agriculture program incentivizes delaying vegetation termination in fallow fields until July 15th or later. Acceptable cover includes planted cover crops or volunteer vegetation, with payment rates of $30 per acre for suitable volunteer vegetation and $110 an acre for established cover crops. The application deadline is April 10th, and applications must be submitted through the CWA website at calwaterfowl.org. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is hosting a virtual public meeting to help with the prioritization of activities within the new era of Smarter Food Safety Framework. The one-day meeting scheduled for Wednesday, April 24th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. The morning session will feature FDA presentations on potential innovative data and technology activities. In the afternoon, stakeholders can provide feedback on leveraging advancements in data and technology to accelerate FDA's efforts in improving public health. Topics include tech-enabled traceability, predictive analytics, data sharing, and technical innovations in equipment design and training methods. Registration for the virtual meeting is free, and individuals will have an opportunity to submit questions for consideration. Questions must be submitted by April 8th. More information about the virtual meeting is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
First cows and now a human, an update on the U.S. bird flu situation coming up on This Land of Ours. Medical professionals have confirmed a rare case of highly pathogenic avian influenza in a human. The infected person is a worker at a dairy in Texas, the state where the HPAI was first found in cattle just days ago. Since that first discovery, the bird flu has also turned up at dairies in Michigan, New Mexico, Idaho, Kansas, and Ohio. It appears to have been introduced into the cattle by wild birds. In Idaho, the virus may have been transmitted from cow to cow. USDA has stated that the initial testing has not found changes to the virus that would make it easier to transmit to humans. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the patient reported eye redness consistent with conjunctivitis as their only symptom and is recovering. The infection does not change the H5N1 bird flu human health risk assessment for the U.S. general public, which CDC considers to be low. USDA recently issued a report looking at how global production of agricultural products has grown and developed over a six-decade period, including the realm of sustainability. Rod Bain delves into the findings of the study in this edition of Agriculture USA.
Just how much has agriculture on a world stage through production, progression, and sustainability transformed since the start of the decade of the 1960s, when this transformative declaration was made.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
We really wanted to get kind of a long-term global picture of where these trends have taken us over the last few decades.
I'm Rod Bain. USDA research economist Keith Fugley joins us as we look at the findings of a recent study on the transformation of global agriculture over the past six decades. In this edition of Agriculture USA, the Agriculture Department's Economic Research Service recently crunched data to get a better idea of how global agricultural production has transformed over a six-decade period since 1961. Among those overseeing this study and reporting on its findings, USDA economic researcher Keith Fugley.
What this report tries to do is look at broad trends in global agricultural production, resource use, and productivity, how productive those resources employed in agriculture have been.
The report not only looks at productivity, but how ag on a world scale has impacted long-term sustainability from 1961 to 2020. First, from the productivity side.
From 1961 all the way up to 2020, global agricultural output increased by about fourfold.
With gross value growing from $1.1 trillion, with a T, dollars at the start of the study period to $4.3 trillion by 2020. Also changed over that same time period, increased diversity of products.
So some of the traditional things like root and tuber crops, cereal grains, they're actually a smaller share of that total output today than they were in prior decades. What has grown are oil seeds, fruits and vegetables, non-ruminant livestock like poultry and pork, and then especially we've seen huge growth in farm-raised fish, or what we call aquaculture.
Land in global agriculture grew 8% during that six-decade time frame. But what Fugley found interesting was the primary location of this growth.
The location of where that output is coming from has really shifted from what we call in the report the global north. That's kind of the high-income countries of North America, Europe, and then Asia Pacific, like Japan and Australia. And it's shifted to the global south, Latin America, Africa, and the rest of Asia.
Irrigated area grew by over two times between 1961 and 2020.
It uses about two-thirds of the world's surface area. Irrigation uses about 70% of the world's freshwater resources.
As far as resource use goes,
agriculture has become more productive. It's reducing the use of those resources around the world. So we're getting a lot more output per unit of land, as well as per unit of labor, but also getting more efficient use of fertilizers. We're reducing the amount of resource of water per output, as well as greenhouse gas emissions per output.
For instance, the amount of labor dedicated to agriculture peaked at over 1 billion people in 2003. By 2020, that total labor force for ag around the world had declined to 840 million people. Meanwhile, the input of feed concentrates made from protein-dense oilseeds and crops has increasingly become an important source of livestock, poultry, and farm-raised fish nutrition over the six-decade period. To get a better idea of the balance between agricultural productivity and sustainability worldwide between 1961 and 2020, the report used a measure known as total factor productivity, a term you might have heard before, as it is the basis of Virginia Tech University's annual Global Agricultural Production Report. In essence, it measures what is produced commodity-wise versus the amount of basic inputs used to raise such product. Keith Fugley explains.
Today, most of the world is on a real TFP growth path where it's new technologies, better farming methods that are raising output and not just bringing in more stuff to produce that output. Now, that's not true everywhere in the world. Africa, for example, lags behind in shifting from sort of what we call resource-dependent growth to productivity-led growth. But the world as a whole now is getting more than two-thirds of its growth from just raising productivity rather than expanding resource utilization.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The days are getting longer and the weather is getting warmer, which means spring planting. Chad Smith has the details.
Todd Hess, planter product manager with Ziegler Ag, says it's time to properly prepare your planter to avoid downtime and ensure the crop gets planted to achieve its highest potential. He says it's important to start with the basics.
Inspect the planter itself. You want to make sure that you review the owner's manual, make sure that all of the recommended maintenance items are being looked at, make sure that we're replacing anything that appears to be worn, visual inspections of everything across the planter. You also want to take a look at the seed delivery hoses, make sure that there's nothing cracked. Parallel arms on the row units, making sure that they're not loose or binding in any way. And just make sure that if if you see anything that looks like it needs to be replaced, make sure that those parts are taken care of if there's anything worn, broken, or missing. Another big thing is to look at the seed meters. Make sure that the seed meters have been calibrated.
It's important to make sure the planter's electronics, monitors, and automated functions are ready for planting.
The most obvious one is to make sure that with all the electronics on planters nowadays, that you're running the latest released software that's approved by the manufacturer, just making sure that that software is installed on the monitor. Make sure you're testing all of the systems, the connections, the electrical connections, be able to test that equipment and that it's working as it should. You know, all the sensors are reporting in their locations, they're reading the information from the planter, and everything looks good and proper that way. The other thing that you really should probably do is with your GPS receiver is make sure that software is up to date as well. Make sure that it sees the satellite signal as you pull things out of the shed.
He talks about how to maximize the uptime of planters in the field.
One of the key things is back to planter maintenance, just making sure that you're checking all the bearings. If you've got ground drive planters, check the chains, make sure that all those systems are operating. You're doing the maintenance that you're supposed to do. That's going to make sure that you've got the optimal window to plant and that you've got minimal downtime. I think the other key thing is to make sure that you've got adequate parts on hand in case you do have an unexpected breakdown, especially the most common items. As dealers, we tend to try to stock as much as we can, but as you know, there's always times where potentially that part isn't available at that local branch, or maybe it's a couple branches away.
When planting season is finished, it's important to put the planter away properly for storage.
The biggest thing that you want to consider before you even think about putting the planter away for the season is it's a great time to hire out some preventative maintenance inspections. That's something we offer here at Ziegler Ag Equipment. We'll take the opportunity to go through your planter, make sure that the meters are calibrated, make sure that everything is in tip-top shape before you put the planter away so that you can have peace of mind that before next planting season, you don't have to worry about some of those things. Of course, you also want to make sure that you're cleaning the equipment off when you're getting ready to put it in the storage. Another good thing to do is to make sure that with your seed meters, you're taking the seed discs out and storing them in a nice, dry, safe environment. If you leave them in your meters, they can have a tendency to warp.
Again, that's Todd Hess from Ziegler Ag. Chad Smith reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Here's today's featured interview.
I'm Catherine Bronski, USDA National Policy Manager with USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service.
All right. So we wanted to talk about invasive pest. Give me the official title. Is it the Invasive Pest Awareness Month?
Yeah, Invasive Plant Pest and Disease Awareness Month.
That's a lot of words.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So most of our listeners, we have a lot of agricultural listeners. We focus on farmers a lot. But since this goes out on the radio and across seven states, we have a lot of listeners who are not in agriculture. And so I'd like to start out by just talking with them about why this is important for them to know about. What can these invasive plant pests mean for just the average listener?
Thanks for having me on your show today to talk about Invasive Plant Pest and Disease Awareness Month and why it matters. We know hungry pests are highly damaging invasive insects and diseases that people can unknowingly spread. These invasive insects and plant diseases cost the U.S. an estimated $40 billion each year in damages to crops, trees, and other plants. Some examples of things to be on the lookout for are fruit flies, citrus greening, spotted lanternfly, and other pests that can damage our crops and agriculture in the U.S. And other pests like the Asian longhorn beetle, spongy moth, and other pests that harm trees and natural resources can really be a problem for our forests.
So in California and Florida, of course, one of the things that we have talked about a lot over the last decade is the Asian citrus, the psyllid. And our listeners are, you know, a little bit more aware of that. We have talked for years about making sure that you're not transporting citrus, the greenery from the plants, or if you're taking, you know, a bag of oranges over to relatives, make sure that there are no, you know, little bugs on them. What should specifically, you know, if we're talking about you know, most of our listeners live in ag land, so it's likely that they're going to have some of these pests around if they're not careful. What should they be watching for, or what kind of actions can they take?
April is a great time to get out and look for these hungry pests because you may be in your garden more or just outdoors more in general, or even traveling. And it's a really key point to look at some of these before they emerge, and they may be a little bit easier to see this time of year. Asian citrus psyllid is a big pest that we are on the lookout for. We have a quarantine in several areas in the United States, including Florida and California. And we do encourage the public and residents not to transport or mail homegrown citrus or citrus plants out of the area, because this could spread the Asian citrus psyllid and the disease that it brings with it, citrus greening, to new areas and really harm our agriculture. You could be on the lookout for citrus fruit that is kind of lopsided or green, doesn't seem to ripen, it's bitter and hard. This is something that is pretty much inedible. Growers can't sell it. They can't even make juice out of it. So it's really important for our citrus industry to be on the lookout and don't spread the citrus plants from your backyard to new areas.
So another pest I've been hearing a lot about, it seems like within the last few days, last few weeks, is the spotted lanternfly. What parts of the U.S. is likely to have a problem with that?
Spotted lanternfly is found in around 17 states at the moment, mostly eastern and midwest states, and it is a great hitchhiker. This leaf-hopping bug transports itself along with people unknowingly, a lot of times on household items, even firewood, and people that live in states like Pennsylvania really need to be on the lookout for it, because these egg masses this time of year can be laid even in wheel wells of cars. So we look for the egg masses, which just look like little dabs of mud, and they are easily able to be scraped off. When you scrape it off and smash it, it'll kill those eggs before it even has a chance to hatch and attack. And the good news is it's not in California. However, it is a very good habitat for spotted lanternfly. So we are on the lookout. We work with our state partners to help stop the spread of this pest. And we really could use the public's help in being on the lookout for it, making sure you know what to look for and how to stop it from spreading by scraping those egg masses or smashing and killing the insects. A lot of information can be found on our website that includes great pictures and other details about the state that you live in. If you go to hungrypest.com, click on the state tracker, and you can find information for your specific state and also information on how to report it to your state plant health director if you find something suspicious that they may want to be aware of.
So you mentioned it when we started, but let's talk a little bit more about the damage that having these invasive pests can do to agriculture. You know, what's a dollar amount that we could say that invasive pests can cause damage in?
Invasive insects and plant diseases cost the U.S. the estimated $40 billion each year in damages to crops, trees, and other plants. We know that more than 21 million jobs depend on the health and sustainability of U.S. agriculture and the related industries. And our farms in America contribute to more than $223 billion to the U.S. gross domestic product. That's from 2022. American agriculture feeds, clothes, and fuels our nation and the world. So protecting our resources from these invasive plant pests also preserves our livelihood, our food security, and their way of life.
So you mentioned a website a few minutes ago. Let's talk about the website again. What was that web address? And it's very easy to remember.
Yes, visit hungrypest.com. And if you click on the state tracker, you can find your local state information and also the state plant health director's contact information, phone numbers or emails to report anything that's suspicious. If you report early, that can really help to reduce the eradication costs that USDA pays and works with our state partners to eradicate and prevent these pests from spreading to new areas.
Perfect. Is there anything else that you would like for our listeners to know?
One thing that I did want to mention, in California, we currently have several federal quarantines for fruit flies. This is something, fruit flies sometimes pops up every year, and we are easily able to eradicate it with the help of the public to not move their homegrown fruit. But this year, we have Oriental, Tao, Queensland, and Mediterranean fruit quarantines all together throughout the state. And these fruit flies attack more than 400 types of fruit and vegetables. So it's really important to not move your homegrown fruit or vegetables out of these areas that are quarantined for a fruit fly. And another tip is to not compost these. Don't let the fruit rot on the ground or in compost bins in the quarantine areas, because these pests can survive. They feed on rotting fruit, and it actually can emerge and infest whole new areas with fruit flies and really harm our agriculture.
That is a great point to make, because it's so easy to just, you know, to add that fruit to your compost pile and not worry about it. But that could actually be helping to spread the fruit flies.
Mm-hmm. And another method that people don't know often spread these invasive pests is they are such good hitchhikers. They hide inside the fruit or vegetables or hide inside the firewood. We want to make sure that as you're traveling from other countries, as you arrive to the United States, you could prevent the next fruit fly outbreak by declaring the fruit that you're bringing with you when traveling. They're asking that question, do you bring any fruit, food, or plants with you, because they could have pests with them. So it's really important. And again, the public can do so much to help us be on the lookout and prevent new pests from establishing in the United States.
Perfect. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This was great.
That website one more time was hungrypests.com. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour now for more news. The first so-called climate-smart food product is hitting grocery shelves. Gary Crawford has the story.
As a consumer, would you be willing to pay a little bit more for a food product proven and certified to have been produced in a way that helps the environment, that helps fight climate change, a so-called climate-smart product? Well, up to now, there's been no way to answer that question, because there haven't been any climate-smart products on grocery shelves until now.
It is an extraordinarily important day for American agriculture and for our country.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack at a rice packaging facility the other day in Milton, Wisconsin, at a celebration for a milestone in the USDA's Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program. That's a USDA program that provides incentives for farmers to adopt climate smart production techniques and practices. It develops ways to accurately measure the results of those practices and develops markets for climate smart products. The projects have been operating for about a year now, and Tom Vilsack held up a plastic bag above his head there.
This is the first commercially produced climate smart product. It's long grain rice. It's a 2-pound bag of rice. The first of what I suspect will be hundreds of products that are produced in the country to respond to consumer demand for sustainably produced food, but also provide an opportunity for farmers to get a better shake in the marketplace.
Now, in the case of rice, it's usually grown in fields that remain flooded during the growing season. Because of that, the crop emits large amounts of methane gas into the air instead of the soil. But under the USDA's Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program, farmers were paid to change how they grow rice, only doing very limited flooding of fields.
When the soil dries, the microbial community goes dormant and the field stops emitting methane.
Arkansas rice grower Jim Whitaker.
What we have found is we're able to cut our methane reduction by 50%. We've cut our water use by about 50%. We're now using less water than cotton, corn, or soybeans. And we're able to lower our fertilizer and maintain or increase yields.
The very essence of the term, climate smart. Right now, there are about 140 climate smart projects going on all across the nation.
What that has done is deliver money back to small communities like mine and keep us economically viable. I'm fifth generation, so I believe the Climate Smart Commodity Program is going to move agriculture faster than anything we've ever seen. I think we're going to move into another era of U.S. ag.
Producing not only climate smart commodities, but also, according to the Ag Secretary, Secretary Vilsack, new opportunities for family farmers.
There's an opportunity here for us to be entrepreneurial. There's an opportunity for us to expand our income. There's an opportunity for us to be sustainable. There's an opportunity for us to provide leadership. There's an opportunity for us to rebuild our rural communities, and that is something certainly to be proud about.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Here's this week's Fungicide Resistance Management Minute, brought to you by Corteva. We are hearing from Lindy Love, Corteva's Strategic Account Manager in Northern California, on the impact of fungicide resistance. Now, Lindy, we've talked a lot about monitoring what's happening in your orchard or your crop, but what about what's going on next door?
It's good to stay in contact with your neighbors to see what they're seeing in the field and if you guys have similar issues. Each area is specific to certain pathogens or disease pressure. Some ranches might, you know, be a colder site or a warmer site or get more rainfall or have more specific issues. So it's important to have that connection with your neighbor to just kind of have the open discussion, what they're seeing in the fields. Are they having any issues? What problems they might be facing, just so that you have an idea of what your neighbor's doing and what is and is not working, and say that they have a specific disease or pathogen present in the field. You want to make sure if it's adjacent to your ranch that you're being proactive with your fungicide program.
And Lindy, where can folks get more information on all of this?
They could contact their local Corteva AgriScience representative or visit corteva.us/fungicide resistance.
Thank you for all this information once again. That was Lindy Love with this week's Fungicide Resistance Management Minute, brought to you by Corteva. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.